Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us. We're going to take a journey on a lot of paths today. Of course, we always start with the latest on health and healing and slowing down and wherever possible, reversing the aging process. There's so much new information on aging that I'll be doing a one-hour special within the next 2 weeks just on aging. I'll also be doing a three-hour special, 1 hour for three straight days, on state of the environment. To get the information in this 3 hours, you would have had to have read at least 100 books, because more than 3,000 articles in the scientific literature, over 100 books from scholars and historians on the climate have been examined in detail. This has taken about 2 years of research to do. We're finally completed with it. It's going through final fact-checking, but you want to hear it because it offers us potential to change, but it also shows very bleakly what's going to happen if we don't. And I don't believe most people will choose to even pay attention. Also today, I'm going to have short piece of information on the environment from at least 10 different sources. I'll also talk about the people are not the enemy, but the police and militarization of America are. John Whitehead, special edition. Also, drugs, money, and political prostitution from a Dr. Navin Gordon. This is about the pharmaceutical companies and how 22 of the leading pharmaceutical companies have settled criminal and civil suits for over $10 billion in fines. No one's gone to jail. Why not? Yet these are the people that we advertise in the media, and then we buy their products. It's not right. The fact that they had the power over our legislation is not right. The fact that they can control the entire area of science, of what is scientific and what is not right. I'll share that. Do you remember the other day I played you a segment, a little longer than normal, about 27 minutes, that talked about artificial intelligence and where we're going with it? Well, someone else has some opinion on this, and it's Professor Stephen Hawkins, and he has some things to say to Wired Magazine that are right in alignment with a quote from Common Dreams. Artificial intelligence, fears Stephen Hawkins, quote, may replace humans altogether. You'd say that's not possible. Normally, if you're dealing with ethical people, it's not. But it's also very definitely a possibility. And then I'm going to have three audio clips this week. They're short. On the real reasons that Hillary Clinton, with the support of her husband and Barack Obama and the entire military-industrial complex and the British government, the French government, the Italian government, all chose, along with Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and Qatar, to invade and destroy Libya. None of what you were told by the mainstream media is true. We will give you the real story, but it's in three parts. And what's most interesting for me is the last part. That last part is 6 years post-destruction of Libya and Gaddafi by people who are part of the resistance, people who are funded by the United States, the CIA, now saying, boy, did they make a mistake. It was so much better under Gaddafi. And everything that they believed would change didn't. And what they saw and what they participated in, they were played. Yeah, and the whole world was played. So why did they fear him so much they had to destroy him? You'll hear that today. Also, you're going to hear a clip from a man I had on the show recently. He is Professor Yanis Varoufakis. He was the former ethical finance minister of Greece, and he quit because he found it so disgusting what they were doing, the European Union and Wall Street, to destroy all quality of life in Greece by punishing the people there with austerity. He has a short little piece about why this was allowed to happen, who's behind it, and why it's going to be happening across the world. And then a CIA agent, who we've had on this program, blows a whistle, quote, here's what he said. We, meaning the CIA, supplied elite pedophiles with children. Why wasn't this picked up by the major media? Who were these elite pedophiles? We'll get into that. As you see, we cover a lot of bases with this show. Let's begin. Always with health leading off. This is a research project done at the Pennsylvania State University, and it was published in the peer-reviewed journal Hypertension. It's about pistachios. Now, I happen to like pistachio nut butter. All that is they take the pistachios raw and organic, and they simply blend it in some kind of blender so you get like a paste. They do the same thing with walnuts and almonds. You can get any kind of nut or seed as a butter, which I would suggest because, A, it's more digestible. B, if you have any problem with fiber in the system, this helps with that. And you're getting something put in a smoothie very easily. But in any case, they say that, quote, eating a handful of pistachio nuts a day can help reduce the damage done to the body by acute stress. And scientists measured their cardiovascular responses when they ate pistachios and then when they didn't. And they found that 1.5 ounces of nuts a day, that's a small amount, that's the amount that would fit in a tablespoon. Quote, daily events such as a tight deadline or public speaking can increase blood pressure. And these results are significant because they show that physiological responses to stress are affected by the foods we eat. Good. So pistachios in the diet. Not the salted, roasted ones. Raw. This is from the American Association for Cancer Research, published in Cancer Research Journal. They talk about postmenopausal women. Most postmenopausal women are overweight, and many are obese. And what happens is that when you're overweight and you're postmenopausal, you really increase your risk of inflammation. Quote, both obesity and inflammation have been shown to be related to severe types of cancer, and this study shows that if you reduce weight, you can reduce inflammation as well. So this program was highly achievable and reproducible, and so here's the takeaway message. You have some silent markers in your blood, ones that you can't feel, and rarely, if ever, are they tested for. One is C-reactive protein. And when you start to diet and you get the fat down, it can drop by as much as 41%. That helps take you out of harm's way. You also have some other fibrinogen and homocysteine. Also, when you're on a plant-based diet, will go down, and those are all important, and especially important if you're postmenopausal. On an upcoming program, I'll be giving you a protocol for every person who is postmenopausal and andropausal. What would be a food that would help with the aging process? I've mentioned many, but here's one we didn't know about. This is cucumbers. That's right. We've always thought of superfoods as being the only thing that would impact the aging process. But now raw organic vegetables are falling into that category. Why? Cucumbers are loaded with silica. That's a mineral. And silica is an essential component of healthy connective tissue. That means your muscles, ligaments, cartilage, bone, and skin. It's also full of ionic potassium and magnesium and vitamin C, which gives it a powerful alkalizing effect within the body. And cucumbers are particularly rich in fluids that hydrate the skin and joints and tissues. And also these lignans, L-I-G-N-A-N-S, include pinoresinol, and these are important in reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease, also breast cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer, and prostate cancer. Additionally, cucumbers contain what are called a triterpene phytonutrients, including curcubitins, A, B, C, D, and E. These are phytonutrients, and they're really important in helping inhibit cancer cell signaling pathways. It also turns off inflammation because it blocks COX-2, and that is very important. And it's also good topically if you take a cucumber and you make a slice and you put it over your eyes. If you got stayed up late and you got baggy eyes, it helps to reassimilate that. And there's natural ascorbic acid and caffeic acid within the cucumber, which prevent water retention in the skin. So that's what reduces the swelling. So if people say, why does cucumbers over the eyes, does it work? Yes. And it's because of ascorbic acid and caffeic acid. So you can now add cucumbers. It can draw out excess fluid. It helps tighten collagen, which has the effect of natural cellulite reduction. And I've suggested for a long time that you combine cucumbers with celery, ginger, and lemon, and green apple. That's a phenomenal health tonic. Purifies the blood, thins the blood, prevents stroke, cleanses the liver, cleanses the kidneys. It's good at every level. From Scientific Daily, a new report on nocebo effect, not placebo effect, and including illness. What it means in lay language is this. Negative suggestion can induce symptoms of illness. And nocebo effects are the adverse effects that occur during sham treatments and or the result of negative expectations. And while the positive counterpart, the placebo effect, has been intensively studied in recent years, the scientific literature contains few studies on nocebo phenomena. In the latest, the Technical University of Munich in Germany presented the neurobiological mechanisms and highlight the relevance of nocebo effect in everyday clinical practice. Let me give you an example. Let's say that we are given some unintended negative suggestion on the part of a doctor or nurse when informing the patient about the possible complications of a proposed treatment. It's assumed that a certain proportion of the undesired effects of the drugs can be attributed to nocebo effect. And the mechanism behind this phenomena are, as with placebo effects, learning by Pavlovian conditioning in reaction to induced expectations. So the consequence is, even though there's nothing there, there's no there there, your belief that something bad is going to happen, your belief that something's going to be taken away or you're going to be arrested, fired, sued, whatever it may be, that will create very real physical manifestation. You can increase your cortisol level. You can increase your adrenaline level. You can exhaust your adrenal glands. That's why people under stress are always exhausted. And you can end up manifesting literal disease by a negative thought. So the nocebo is very powerful. That's why you should not be around people who have are always attached to some negative, critical, self-righteous, kind of almost submerged but rageful energy. When you see someone gossiping, get away from them. When you see someone trying to share something, if it's not love and if it doesn't help enhance your life, say, sorry, friend, not for me. Hang up the phone, walk away from them. That's your right, because if you absorb that information, there's a vibration and a frequency, the vibration that comes with it, and literally can get you a disease in the process, especially if it's chronic. Some evidence supports the health benefit of mindful, baneful, based meditation. For all of you who just attended our one-month retreat, we only had 12 people for a month because I wanted to see what we could do in a controlled environment. You see, it's one thing when people are in your office, and I'll give you this as an example. I only work with terminally ill people, and I got a long list of people I work with. Even when I'm out of town, even when I didn't have anything but a cell phone, I was able to counsel people every day. And I do it almost every day of the week. But when I'm in New York and people make an appointment and they have proof that they're terminally ill, then I'm happy to see them. And of course, I never charged a person in my life. So when you're giving your time to someone, you hope that they are going to respect the fact that they're getting something that could save their lives and it's not costing them. So this well-known person, in the music business was brought by someone who is a friend of theirs. And I spent 2.5 hours with the person, going over everything they had to do to help them with some very serious and indeed terminal condition. Not one, but two conditions. And so my final comment was, do you intend to apply this in any way? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, right now, right this second, I'm on a whole new road. I mean, you've laid it out for me, you know. But my doctors also told me there was no hope, but you've given me hope. You've let me know there's another way. I said, well, remember, you're not going to have a coach there. Your friend has his own life. He brought you here today, but you're going to have that discipline not to allow that subconscious and epigenetic self to keep talking in your ear saying, no, what's the big deal? You know, French fries, hot dogs, hamburgers, cola, it's not going to kill you. So just remember, yes, it will, because you're not 21 anymore and you cannot abuse your immune system. He said he got it. And so we got up and shook hands and he walked downstairs. About a half hour later, I walked downstairs because I was going to go for a walk in the park. And right on the corner from my office at 83rd and Broadway, there he sat eating a hamburger with a cola, smoking a cigarette, and French fries. Okay. Remember, people may say that they want the benefits of change. It doesn't mean that they're willing to change. Now, when you're with someone for a month, they don't have that opportunity. There's no junk food to eat. There's no place to go to. And their whole day is spent in journaling, watching films, asking questions, bonding with nature, and trying to at least come to resolves that can allow them a new way of living. Now, that's one of the reasons that in our society, we rarely take the time to go any place. Because we think, well, you know, I got it. I read this book. I saw someone on television. I was listening to this show and I heard something. That's not what causes people to change. You really have to have discipline to change. And one of the ways we can gain discipline is with mindfulness-based meditation. What do I mean? Let's just say that you go to a park. Anywhere. We're heard all over the world, so everyone listening has some place they can go to. And you just sit and you pay attention to some object. Might be a waterfall, might be a tree, might be a view, looking out at the river, a lake, the ocean. But at least keep your focus on that and don't allow any other thoughts into your mind. As thoughts come in, just say, nope, nope, nope. And you keep your focus upon that which is right in front of you. And so you can relax into being present with that. Now, if you keep practicing this, your concentration and your discipline will allow you to become more conscious for a longer period of time. You become more aware of your environment. Because I remember walking down Amsterdam, and I was going down to a vegan restaurant, and I was noticing how absolutely scuzzy and dirty and ramshackled everything looked. But there was garbage piled up on the left-hand side of the sidewalk. There was a relatively maybe 3 feet you could walk, but every single one of those outdoor cafes was packed. The smells were offensive. The noise was thick. The pollution was substantial. The environment was, well, it was pure scuzz. And that's not even talking about the quality of the food. It's just letting you know that we tune out frequently the entire consequence of the environment that we're in. You see it all the time. Kids in the museum, but they're looking down at their iPhones instead of the artwork that's in front of them. So if you discipline yourself each day, starting with maybe half hour, that can make a difference. Here's what Science Daily says. Quote, specific types of mindfulness practices, including Zen meditation, have demonstrated benefits for patients with certain physical and mental health problems. Quote, an extensive review of therapies that included meditation as a key component referred to as mindfulness-based practices shows convincing evidence that such interventions are effective in the treatment of psychiatric symptoms, including pain, and when used in combination with more conventional therapies. And this was from a hospital. So there's Zen meditation. That's more of a Buddhist spiritual practice that involves the practice of developing mindfulness by meditation, typically focusing upon awareness of breathing patterns. And there's mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is a method of using Buddhist mindfulness, combining meditation with yoga, and that's better able to help people cope with stress. So, but whatever you do, just start doing it. Also, finally, there's some remarkable benefits to something we rarely hear about, and that is the pumpkin seed. Pumpkin seeds, like all edible seeds, are packed with immense nutritional and medicinal nutrients. And one cup serving of pumpkin seeds has zinc and copper, magnesium and manganese and potassium and iron. And that helps us with anemia. So you could think of that. But pumpkin seeds are great. But also pumpkin seed butter is terrific too. You can take a scoop of that, a tablespoon of that, put it in your smoothie in the morning. And it's particularly good for men for your prostate. Because why? The pumpkin seed oil shows the ability to inhibit testosterone-induced prostate growth. And that's a common causative factor in benign prostatic hyperplasia. It can help with postmenopausal symptoms. If you have 2,000 milligrams of, which is not a lot, that's 2 grams of pumpkin seed oil, over the course of 12 weeks each day, you can reduce your blood pressure and increase your HDL cholesterol, that's the good cholesterol, as well as reducing the severity of hormone insufficiency associated with hot flashes and headaches and joint pain. Additionally, experimental research indicates that adverse cardiovascular changes associated with estrogen deficiency, such as blood pressure and lipid abnormalities, can be mitigated. And it also helps reduce calcium oxalate kidney stones. It's good for your liver. And in fact, a mixture of flaxseed and pumpkin seed have found heart protective and liver protective properties. And if you know anyone who's got drug toxicity or chemical toxicity, the protein isolate of pumpkin seed has been shown to alleviate toxicity of the liver. It's good for arthritis. It's good for hypertension. And it's good for parasites. It's good for insomnia and anxiety. And all that's from good quality scientific literature. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. We're 23 minutes into the program. Let me just mention two numbers. Because with a society that is constantly moving about, you never know at noon, Monday to Friday, and 7 o'clock on Tuesday, where you're going to be. So if you're out and about and you still want to hear the show live, there's a number you can call. Please write this down. You never know when you're going to turn on a radio or go on the internet if you're near one and or not be able to get to the internet, and so you need this. 424-203-8046. 424-203-8046. But if you want to listen at the archive later in the day, maybe in the evening, you missed a show, now you can retrieve it. 701-719-9976. That's 701-719-9976. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Texas way, for I learned to walk, I learned to play. Music ringing, burning in my ears. I had to pack my bag to get out of there.
I want to share some commentaries now. Some are my own that I've written over the weekend, and others are from other reporters and journalists. This is from George Ochinski, and it's about our national parks are in peril. I'll just quote a little bit of this. It says, recent moves by the Trump administration are putting our premier national parks in peril. And unfortunately for Montanians, this attack on what has been called America's best idea is being led by Interior Secretary Ron Zinke, a Montanan who self-describes as a Teddy Roosevelt Republican. But if Teddy Roosevelt was alive today, he'd undoubtedly be whacking Zinke about the head and shoulders with his swagger stick for attempting to destroy the legacy he so presently left for future generations. As it is, Teddy is probably rolling over in his grave, as Zinke and Trump's plans is to basically hand over our national parks and wildlife refuges and coastal waters to none other than the fossil fuel corporations, who will ravage them for private profit. Now, growing up next to Glacier National Park, one might think that Zinke had some idea of the incredible beauty of that led to Glacier being declared a national park. Millions of people from all over the world have flocked to Glacier since its inception, and in recent years, the park has been setting new visitation records every year. With its crystalline waters, majestic peaks, and groves of ancient trees and ice-filled glacier basins, Glacier is indeed a jewel to be cherished and respected and preserved for generations to come. Surely Zinke knows that people do not come to Glacier to see big oil rigs, breathe toxic emissions, wander through clear-cut forests, or share the narrow park roads with ore trucks. Nor do they go to other national parks for a relaxing dose of industrialized landscapes and waters. Yellowstone was America's and the world's first national park, and remains a national treasure that draws millions of visitors to stand in awe of the geothermal wonders, not the controversial cell towers at Mount Washburn. Yet while calling for slashing the budget for national parks by the largest amount in 75 years, President Trump issued an executive order in March requiring Zinke to conduct a review of existing rules and policies on drilling that, quote, may unduly burden the development of domestic energy resources beyond the degree necessary to protect the public interest or otherwise comply with the law. Mind you, this pressing concern about causing the oil and gas industry any problems in further exploiting public lands and waters comes at a time when the globe is deluged in so much oil and gas that prices are less than half what they were only a few years ago. So the clock's ticking. So everyone in this audience, I know that you care about our national parks. So please tell your legislator no to this. What's it take to engage in resistance? And I'm talking about peaceful resistance. For those, and we don't have a lot. Probably, I'm going to guess, in the neighborhood of around 5,000 people who, throughout their lives, not just a one-off, but have been consistent in addressing social issues. The people who stand up against the abuses and lies and deception in vaccines. The people who stand up against genetic engineered materials and foods, the people who want to see nuclear power plants close, like Harvey Wasserman, and the people who stand up like Ellen Brown and Michael Hudson, outstanding economist, she's also a lawyer, against the abuses in banking. It wasn't one time they did it. They didn't take a weekend to demonstrate. It's part of their whole life. So what does it cost you when you decide to go up against these people? Well, according to Chris Hedges, a lot. We have to understand, there's no reason we all should not be resisting on some issues, because there's so many different issues that are wrong. We should be addressing them. But resistance entails some suffering also. It requires a self-sacrifice. It accepts that we may be destroyed. That's possible. They can destroy your career. You think not? Well, I've got some examples for you. Now, mind you, these are real examples of what happens when you decide that you want to tell the truth. This is from Zero Hedge. It's called "The Crackdown Has Begun." I talked about this a year ago. Google permanently bans 200 fake news sites. And that's what the mainstream media picks up. Is it true? Are these fake news sites? Well, in a blog post by Scott Spencer, Director of Product Management for Sustainable Ads, just this last week, Google said it has banned 200 publishers from accessing its AdSense advertising service for posting fake news stories, meaning we're banning you because you produce fake news. So we decided to do our own homework. And because we have scholars in residence and headed up by Richard Gehl, one of the eminent or research scholars in the United States, we decided to say, who are they banning? I'm interested in this. Well, here are the ones that are legitimate. This is the sacrifice you pay when you tell the truth against the corporate or the government establishment. Now it's one and the same. Listen to the names. Activist Post, the Revolutionary War Word Press. We have a Tribune, a Tribune.com. There's over 200. Ancient Code, Antiwar.com. And I'm looking at the Black Agenda Report. That's Nellie Bailey and Glenn Ford and Bruce Dixon. You don't get any better at journalism, investigative reporting, than them, and yet they're banned. I'm looking now at Before It's News. That's a good one. Assassination Science. Now, these you may not have heard of, but they're good. Good people working there. Consortium News, that's another great one. Collective Evolution, Counterparts. I'm going down like Counterpunch, wow. Daily Stormer, Dark Politics, Defend Democracy Press, EndingTheft.com, that's about government theft. So I'm looking at hundreds of names, all of these now banned. Gaia.com, why in the world would they ban Gaia? That's about as soft as you can get, yet they do good work. I guess anything spiritual threatens them. Heresy Blog, the Alternative News. So these are banned, and U.S. Police Show, USA News, Home, Veterans News, Veterans Stories. Wow. So many good ones. Now they're all banned. So it was coming, it's here, and so we should be concerned. So for those people, and by the way, most of those journalists, and they a lot of them like Truthdig has some really good journalists, you pay a price. Like Chris Hedges worked for the New York Times, won a Pulitzer Prize. Christian Science Monitor was overseas for years. So they left the mainstream and went over to these posts because of it was about not the pursuit of happiness, but about the pursuit of freedom. Resistance accepts that even if we fail, there is an inner freedom that comes with defiance. And perhaps this is the only freedom and true happiness we will ever know. To resist evil is the highest achievement of human life. It is the supreme act of love. It is to carry the cross, as the theologian James Cone reminds us, and to be acutely aware that what we are carrying is also what we will die upon. Now, most of those who resist, think back, Sitting Bull, Emma Goodman, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Gandhi, they were defeated, at least in the cold calculation of the power. The final and perhaps most important quality of resistance, as Cone writes, is that it inverts the world's value system. Hope rises out of defeat. Those who resist stand, regardless of the cost, with the crucified. And this is their magnificence and their power. The seductive inducements to conformity. What am I talking about? I'm talking about money and fame and prizes and generous grants and huge book contracts and hefty lecture fees and important academic and political positions and a public platform are scorned by those who resist. The rebel does not define success the way the elites define success. Those who resist refuse to kneel before the idols of mass culture and the power elites. They are not trying to get rich. They do not want to be part of the inner circle of the powerful. They accept that when we stand with the oppressed, we get treated like the oppressed. I saw this with Linus Pauling and Abram Hoffer and some remarkable individuals who had made major achievements, had never been criticized, not once, until they challenged the pharmaceutical industry's power, and then they were crucified. Robert Mendelssohn. Oh, my goodness. Warren Levin. All attacked, not because they did anything wrong, but because they were on the wrong side of power. The inversion of the world's value system makes freedom possible. Those who resist are free not because they have attained many things or high positions, but because they have so few needs. They sever the shackles used to keep most people enslaved, and this is why the elites fear them. The elites can crush them physically, but they cannot buy them off. The power elites attempt to discredit those who resist. They force them to struggle to make an income. They push them to the margins of society. They write about them in such ways that there's only one narrative about you, and it's the official narrative, and generally it's what's on Wikipedia, and Wikipedia, in my opinion, is just worthless. And not only that, but as you will see on this program and upcoming programs, we have uncovered a lot of nefarious activity on the part of Wikipedia, and it's being used by intelligence agencies and corporate interest to besmirch people's reputations. There are great people in our journalistic world who have told the truth. Celia Farber is at the high end of that list, and she took a beating with her reputation, not because she had lied, but because she had told the truth. Had she just gone along with all the other reporters talking about AIDS and talking with Anthony Fauci and Robert Gallo as if they were the bearers of truth, she wouldn't have been attacked. But for those of us in the field of real journalism, those of us who do our homework, those of us who pride ourselves in scholarship and not making up our opinion in advance, but allowing the facts to determine the outcome, she deserves a special place in the American understanding, because if you only knew what they did with this woman, they can do it over the internet. They can have 1,000 attacks against your character. They can make lies and slander. And there's no better place in lies and slander than Pacifica. It's masterdom. God, what hypocrisy. What absolute total hypocrisy. Everything is its opposite. When you look, open the door and see what's there. KPFA in Berkeley, California. If I was allowed a show there, I wouldn't go on. In fact, recently I was asked to fundraise for those people around the country. I refuse to, because I know the truth. Where you can libel and slander people with no consequence. And that's what people do today. You can lie about anyone, say anything, with little negative pushback in return. But remember, power is a poison. It doesn't matter who wields it, whether you're a non-commercial radio station or whether you're a major corporation. If you're using the power you have to stay on the air and you don't deserve to be on the air and you have a tiny little audience, but it's your tiny little audience, and you don't care about the station, you don't care about its mission, you give a damn about any of it. All you care about is, I've got my place and I'm not going, and don't try to make me go because I'm going to fight getting off the air. Well, what about the larger good? There is no larger good when it comes to power. There's never been a larger good when it comes to power. The rebel, for this reason, is an eternal heretic. He or she will never fit into any system. The rebel stands with the powerless. There will always be powerless people. There will always be injustice. The rebel will always be an outsider. So resistance requires eternal vigilance. The moment the powerful are no longer frightened, the moment the glare of the people is diverted and moments no longer matter because their movements have taken their place, and then the movement becomes what you focus on. The moment the ruling elites are able to use propaganda and censorship to hide their aims, the gains made by resistors roll backwards. We have seen steadily stripped of everything that organized working men and women who rose up in defiance and were purged, demonized, and killed by the capitalist elites achieve with the New Deal. The victories of African Americans who paid with their bodies and blood to make possible the Great Society and ending legal segregation also have been reversed. The corporate state makes no pretense of addressing social inequality or white supremacy. It practices only the politics of vengeance. It uses coercion and fear and violence and police terror and mass incarceration as social control. Our cells of resistance have to be rebuilt from scratch. The corporate state, however, it is in trouble. It has no credibility. All the promises of the free market and globalization and trickle-down economics have been exposed as lies. An empty ideology used to satiate greed. The elites have no counter-argument to their anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist critics. The attempt to blame the electoral insurgencies in the United States, two ruling parties, both equally corrupt. You couldn't get any more corrupt than the Clintons and everyone around them and the media that supports them, the New York Times, MSNBC, all the dancing clowns over there. Freaks. They're not real journalists. I don't care how many awards they get from organizations that give them awards, like in Hollywood for just showing up. It doesn't matter that your research and your positions would not withstand any scrutiny. That's why you don't see real people, real journalists on there being debated. So everything is an illusion today. Everything. The U.S. government is completely subservient, every single office of government, to corporate power. And this has become a burlesque. The last vestige of the rule of law is evaporating. The kleptocrats are pillaging and looting like barbarian hordes. Programs instituted to protect the common good, the public education, our welfare, and environmental regulations are being dismantled. The bloated military is sucking the marrow out of the nation, and it's unassailable. Poverty is a nightmare. Where are they at the New York Times? My goodness, how low on the scale of enabling deceit when you say that the unemployment rate is 4.1%. Clearly you have someone at the New York Times who understands basic economics, except the fools that call themselves that. If you have 96 million Americans who are unemployed, who used to work, and you do not differentiate those who are part-time from full-time, then you have an unemployment rate of around 24%. And that would make us the worst country in the westernized bloc, worse than Great Britain, worse than, we're right up there with Spain. And yet we don't want the world to see us for what we are. We're in debt to $200 trillion. Our debt to gross domestic product makes us the most indebted nation in the world. We're completely bankrupt. We can never pay back any of this money, any of it, because we do not have the political will to. There are no shortages of artists and intellectuals and writers. We have our modern-day James Baldwins and George Orwells who warned us that this dystopian era was fast approaching. But in our Disney-fied world of intoxicating and endless images, cult of the self and willful illiteracy will not listen. And we will pay for our negligence. I'm very concerned that we're not even paying attention to the basics, like how we become a police state. How much longer can we sustain the fiction that we live in a constitutional republic? I don't know, but anarchy is being loosed upon the nation. We're witnessing the unraveling of the American dream, one injustice at a time. Day after day, the government's crimes against the citizenry grow more and more egregious, more treacherous, and more tragic. And day after day, the American people wake up a little more to the grim realization that they have become captives in a prison of their own making. No longer are we a free people. Oh, yeah, you can go out and do a lot today, and no one's going to stop you. But why don't you ask yourself what it's like to be poor, and now there's a law in your community, over 69 communities in the United States and cities, where you cannot, as a citizen, feed a person who is hungry. Homelessness has become a crime. We've been able to pathologize being poor. I even posted on my website a picture of a park bench that now you have to put money in it, otherwise these spikes come up through the seat, making sure that no homeless person has a place to sit or lie down. That's what we become. We are now pushed and prodded and watched over by twitchy, hypersensitive, easily concerned armed guards who care little about our rights, humanity, or well-being of those in their care. The death toll is mounting. Carnage is heartbreaking, and the public's faith in the government to do its job, which is to protect our freedoms, is deteriorating. We have allowed what should have been a small government that is not politicized, that takes care of the common needs and helps with specific issues. We've been allowed it to become a monster, completely metastasized cancer on the psyche of the American people. It is utterly corrupt. So all you have to do is take a look at what we become. We're getting killed execution style. We're getting hammered. And we have the police to blame for it, because when was the last time they chose to talk someone out of a problem instead of looking at the person as the problem? Oh, and by the way, if you don't think it's that bad, I suggest you take a look at an article that I'm posting today by Naviz Ahmed. And it was published in the Insurge Intelligence, a very good crowdfunded investigative journalism project for the people and the planet. A new study authorized by the former U.S. government intelligence analysts and staff members have concluded that ISIS received significant state sponsorship money up through 1916. And the study is corroborated by revelations from two former senior British intelligence officials and exclusive interviews with Insurge. And the new evidence raises urgent questions, but will not be addressed by any of the media. Is it true that the United States or any of its intelligence agencies, including the CIA, funded any terrorist group, al-Nusra, ISIS, al-Qaeda? Did we know that our partner in NATO, Turkey, was a primary staging place with its own hospitals and training and vehicles and arms and funding for ISIS? Because that should immediately cause NATO to be called into question as supportive and complicit in all this. And was it about controlling the oil in the region? And who profited? And yes, the answer is yes to all that. The United States was complicit. The CIA was complicit. Now ask yourself, when was the last time that this illegal organization was ever held accountable to anything? And it hasn't been. Now I want you to hear the real reason, we're going to play this audio clip now, the real reason that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and NATO were interested in destroying
something else. You're going to be targeted. There were two conferences on this, one in 96 and another one in the year 2000, called the World Mataba Conference, organized by Gaddafi. And everybody was interested. I think most countries in Africa were keen.
Gaddafi didn't give up. In the months leading up to the military intervention, he called on African and Muslim nations to join together to create this new currency that would rival the dollar and euro. They would sell oil and other resources around the world only for gold dinars. It's an idea that would shift the economic balance of the world. Countries' wealth would depend on how much gold they have, not how many dollars they trade. And Libya has 144 tons of gold. The UK has double that, but 10 times the population.
If Gaddafi had an intent to try to reprice his oil or whatever else the country was selling in the global markets and accept something else as a currency, or maybe launch a gold dinar currency, any move such as that would certainly not be welcomed by the power elite today, who are responsible for controlling the world's central banks. So yes, that would certainly be something that would cause his immediate dismissal and the need for other reasons to be brought forth for removing him from power.
It's happened before. In 2000, Saddam Hussein announced Iraqi oil would be traded in euros, not dollars. Sanctions and an invasion followed.
African resistance to AFRICOM was spearheaded by a figure who had emerged as a major economic and political force on the continent and had been a thorn in the side of the West for decades.
From the beginning of his political career as a leader, Muammar Gaddafi was opposed to a foreign military presence in Africa. One of the first things he did after coming to power in 1969 was to expel the British and US military bases in Libya itself. And Gaddafi had, you know, considerable political support across the continent for his position. Nelson Mandela's view was almost identical to Gaddafi's, that there would be no African forces commanded by foreign military officials, and there would be no foreign militaries occupying any part of Africa or operating within Africa.
Gaddafi had been playing a complex game with the West for a long time. President Ronald Reagan had labeled him the Mad Dog of the Middle East and had tried to assassinate him in 1986 by bombing his palace. The Libyan leader's independence and influence flowed from the vast petroleum reserves, the largest in Africa, which he had nationalized when he took power.
Well, starting in the 1990s, Muammar Gaddafi became a kind of luminary, a leading voice, certainly one of the loudest voices, for a maximum vision of African integration. He was seen across Africa as being the successor of Kwame Nkrumah in terms of his vision of African unity. And it wasn't just a matter of nice-sounding words. Gaddafi was eager to not only accelerate the process of African integration, but of bankrolling the process.
The money from Libyan oil allowed Gaddafi to underwrite ambitious projects. $300 million for the first Pan-African satellite RASCOM. $30 billion in the largest irrigation system in the world that draws on the vast reserves of fresh water under the Sahara to turn tens of thousands of hectares of Libyan desert into farmland. Gaddafi demonstrated that Africa could develop without depending on the Western banking system or the International Monetary Fund.
Libya, to the tune of tens of billions of dollars in each case, was capitalizing a number of new African economic institutions, the African Development Bank, the African Monetary Fund. Africa would then develop its own solutions and develop its own lending programs to address its own problems. So Africa was, in Gaddafi's view, and with Gaddafi's leadership, increasingly becoming something of a bloc, rather than a series of disparate individual nations that could be dealt with one-on-one and set against each other.
When Gaddafi was elected chairman of the African Union in 2009, U.S. officials were concerned. In an embassy cable revealed by WikiLeaks, they noted that Libya will seek to use al-Gaddafi's chairmanship to aggrandize him and promote his United States of Africa proposal. U.S. multinationals were also unhappy with the Libyan leader, especially his decision to cancel a $1 billion deal with the Bechtel Corporation, the largest engineering company in the United States with powerful connections in Washington. The fact that an operator with Bechtel's savvy and deep pockets was ultimately unable to secure its contract serves as a cautionary tale for the many U.S. and Western companies seeking to enter Libya's booming market, and for other U.S. companies considering major investment projects here. Gaddafi also antagonized France. After being courted by President Nicolas Sarkozy, the Libyan leader canceled major arms deals.
On oublie à quel point Sarkozy avait déroulé le tapis rouge à Colonel Gaddafi en décembre 2007 et le Colonel Gaddafi, en échange, lui avait promis 14 milliards de dollars de contrats. Il y avait une shopping list absolument incroyable. Finalement, Gaddafi a ridiculisé Nicolas Sarkozy parce qu'il n'y a rien eu du tout ou très très peu de choses par rapport à ce qui avait été promis.
In March 2011, as the Arab Spring spread through North Africa, France and the United States decided to act. The United Nations Security Council gave its approval. Protecting human rights provided the justification.
Nos forces aériennes s'opposeront à toute agression des avions du colonel Gaddafi
contre la population de Benghazi.
We hit Gaddafi's troops in neighboring Ajibia, allowing the opposition to drive them out. We hit Gaddafi's air defenses.
This was AFRICOM's first war, and its commander-in-chief was the first African-American president.
In the words of the Obama administration, the U.S. position in the war against Libya was that of leading from behind. What is really interesting is, of course, the fact that the war was opened and directed first by AFRICOM, and then the mission was taken over by NATO. In other words, the people running the show, NATO, are themselves being run by the United States, which is formally in command of NATO. Not only that, in one of his speeches, Obama, after the bombing campaign had ceased and was praising the efforts of allies in Libya, revealed that even a number of French bombing missions were in fact piloted by American pilots.
You see, everything you've been told is a lie by the administration, by Obama, Clinton, and the media. The media could have found this information out. We did. The media could have found out that the people of Libya loved Gaddafi, and therefore he was not killing his own citizens. That's been confirmed, but he had resources. Imagine one man with the wealthiest nation in Africa, the most educated nation in Africa, the most rights of any Muslim woman in the world was a Libyan woman, and sharing the wealth with his public and highest educational standards in Africa, free education, free housing, everything was supported. And now he was organizing all of Africa as the head of its new agency and shifting over from the American dollar to the gold dinar. That would have meant that had Gaddafi and Libya not been destroyed, today it's highly probable that you would have seen prosperity coming to African countries. You would not have in at least 17 countries in Africa, you would not have had terrorist bases. No, you would have had higher education. You would have had less drought because his irrigation project, most advanced in the world, would have supported those farmers with water. You would have had peace and prosperity coming to Africa. And Gaddafi would be heading that. And the United States and its major corporations were not behind that. They felt threatened, especially Sarkozy and the other corporations that were losing out on all these contracts. Now look at what China is doing. I'll get to China on an upcoming program, let you know why the future in Africa is China's, not the United States. We're there to build military bases, and they're there to build alliances and a new spice road, thousands of miles long, over $2 trillion in expense, and over 67 countries have already signed on to be partners with them in this. They'll be prospering. New country companies, new employment will go up, unemployment will go down, and at the same time, we're bombing and droning. I wonder who's going to win that outcome. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Noll. Have a nice day.